All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it is May 3rd. May 3rd already, amazing. Okay, so you got done with your fourth test, and your grades are online. If you want me to calculate what you need for a particular grade in the class, stop by, and I'll show you how to calculate it. But basically, you know how many points are in the class, and you need 90% for an A, 80% for B. And so in the syllabus, it tells you how many points you need for B, for instance. All right, but that's at the beginning of the class. You know how many points you have already. That's in Blackboard. Subtract the two, and that will tell you how many points you need to get from now to the end of the class. And then you can divide that number by how many points are left in the class. Again, you can get that information from Blackboard, and you can calculate the percentage of what you need. Right? If you need more points than there are remaining in the class, then you can't get that grade. But if there are more points in the class than you need, then it's just some percentage of whatever that is to give you a good ballpark reading on that. All right, so we're going to start chapter 14. You know, it's kind of looking like we're going to have the following chapters on the final exam, 14, 16, and 17. 14, 16, and 17. Looks like the chapters we're going to have on that final exam. All right, so today we're going to start talking about cardiac output, blood flow, and blood pressure. I put some stuff on the board that maybe you should copy down right away, but I'm going to have to get these lights. I'll work on the lights in just a little bit. I want you to be aware of what the physical dimensions of these various parameters are. All right, what does SV stand for? Stroke volume, right? And what are the physical dimensions of stroke volume? And, or as a matter of fact, just think about what is stroke volume, just in English. It's just the amount of blood that's pumped out of the heart every time it beats, right? And the amount of blood that's pumped out is a volume. So you could think of what's your measurement of a volume? What's the unit that you use for volume? Milliliters, and that's exactly the same thing as what, a cubic centimeter, right? A cubic centimeter or a milliliter. So stroke volume will be milliliters, right, per every time the heart beats. Milliliters per beat, but that's a volume. That's a cube. Think of a cube. All right, heart rate. What are the dimensions of heart rate? It is what? You can calculate that. Well, you're counting your pulse, and you count for a minute. So it would be what? Beats per minute. How many times your heart contracts in a minute? So this is beat per minute. Just the number of times your heart beats per minute. All right, cardiac output. We got to define that. I think maybe we defined that already. Cardiac output is when you multiply stroke volume times heart rate. It's a flow. It's a measurement of flow. And flow is a volume per time. How much volume is actually moving through a cross-section per time. So it is going to be milliliters per minute. So if you want to stop at a gas station and fill your gas tank up, you need a certain flow rate, right? If you know the flow rate, then you know how long to keep the nozzle open to get that amount of volume inside your gas tank. All right, now there's something, blood velocity. What the heck is velocity? Velocity, cardiac output, you know what, I'm going to put flow here, right, is cardiac output, but velocity, what the heck is velocity? Velocity is different than flow. What do you measure when you're driving down the 405? A flow or a velocity of your car? Yeah, it's a velocity. So it's just a distance per time, right? So a distance per time, and the distance that we were talking about was in these milliliters right here. What's a milliliter again? The dimensions would be a centimeter, right? So velocity would be a centimeter per time, maybe a centimeter per second. Those are the dimensions. So I don't want you to confuse cardiac output with the stroke volume or velocity or any of that kind of stuff. So just put that little cheat sheet someplace handy so that you can see these things. All right, I got a couple terms on the board right here, chronotropy and inotropy. These refer to the heart, physical parameters of the heart, and it's not too hard to remember these, but maybe just write it down anyway. What does chrono mean? What's the root time? So that has something to do with time. And what do we see in time over here? Heart rate, beat per minute. All right, so chronotropy has to do with the timing of the heart or the heart rate. So it is related to heart rate. All right, so if it's somebody's given a positive chronotropic agent, Guess what it does to heart rate? It increases it. If somebody's given a negative inotropic agent, what happens to heart rate? Decreases. And as a matter of fact, you probably know two nervous systems. One is a positive chronotropic effect, and the other produces a negative chronotropic effect. So what nervous system produces a negative chronotropic effect? The parasympathetic, and sympathetic, right, produces a positive chronotropic effect on the heart. It speeds up the heart is what we mean. Now this one over here, inotropy, I don't think we've talked about that, but we will talk about that one today. It doesn't have to do with heart rate, but it has to do with force of contraction or strength of contraction. Sometimes we call that contractility. All right, so let's just put contractility here, of the heart in particular. Contractility. That's the force of contraction of the heart. And you know that your heart can beat weakly or strongly. Like if you're presented with a really threatening situation, not only does your heart rate increase, but the force of contraction increases. And if it's really a life-threatening circumstance, your heart is going to feel like it's going to jump out of your chest, right? Because it's contracting very, very strongly. All right, and again, okay, you know one nervous system that is a positive chronotropic can have a positive inotropic effect on the heart. A positive inotropic agent would be what nervous system? The sympathetic, yeah, or anything that increases sympathetic tone like adrenaline, right, which is another name for epinephrine floating around from the adrenal gland. Okay, so I want you to know something about chronotropy and inotropy. All right, let's start talking about this particular chapter after I turn some of these lights down a little bit. Probably I want to try to keep that one on. All right, can you see the slides? More or less, good enough? Okay. The screen is going to readjust, but we're going to proceed. All right, cardiac output is the first term. Okay, and what's the best way to think of cardiac output? Is it a flow or a velocity or what is it? It's a flow. And how do we measure flow? Flow is a volume per time, and a convenient measurement would be cubic centimeters or a milliliter per time. All right, so cardiac output is the volume of blood pumped out of the heart each minute, okay, by each ventricle. And the right and left ventricle should have about the same cardiac output. All right, stroke volume is what? The amount of blood that's pumped per beat. All right, and so we can calculate the cardiac output, which is the blood pumped per minute, by just multiplying the stroke volume times the heart rate to calculate cardiac output. So let's just do that to see if that makes sense. So cardiac output, we said, has to be what? Milliliters per minute. And that is going to be heart rate. And what is the heart rate? That is beats per minute. And then we're going to multiply that times stroke volume. And what are the dimensions of stroke volume? It is milliliters per beat. All right, so now we see that that really makes perfect sense because what happens to the beats? They cancel out. We're left with what? Milliliters per minute. Right, and is that a good, valid dimension for flow? Yeah, because it's a volume per time. Right, so you can calculate all these things. And then here's just a little random fact that you should probably be aware of. The total blood volume in an average person is about 5.5 liters. Okay, so that's cardiac output and how you would calculate it. So, cardiac output, is it directly related or inversely related to stroke volume? This is how I want you to think of these different parameters today. Directly related or inversely related. So what are we interested in? This term right here, this one, and this one. So if heart rate increases, what happens to cardiac output? It goes up as well. So it is directly related. What about stroke volume? If stroke volume increases, what happens to cardiac output? It goes up as well. Right? Can everybody kind of see that little algebraic relationship? That's because heart rate is directly related to cardiac output. Stroke volume is directly related to cardiac output. If it was inversely related, then some of these parameters would be not in the numerator, but in a denominator. Then we would say it is inversely related. So that if that parameter increased, then the relationship would then decrease the cardiac output right here. All right, so stroke volume and heart rate are directly related to cardiac output. So if your body needs to increase cardiac output, how can it do that? By increasing heart rate or increasing stroke volume or increasing both. Okay. Okay, so regulation of chronotropy in the heart. And what's chronotropy referring to? It's the heart rate, and we want to separate that from the inotropic effects on the heart, so just the timing of the heart. Without neuronal influences, what controls the heart rate? It is the SA node, the pacemaker of the heart, will drive the heart rate according to its spontaneous activity, and it just has the highest rate of spontaneous depolarization, so it captures the whole heart rate. Right? Normally, the sympathetic and parasympathetic activity influences heart rate. Okay, and they have, we just said what the effects were, the chronotropic effects of the parasympathetic and sympathetic, because it's going to adjust some ion channels that are in the membranes of the sinoatrial node. All right, so autonomic innervation of the SA node is the main controller of heart rate. All right, so sympathetic and parasympathetic nerve fibers both innervate the SA node. So here we see some graphs of membrane potential versus time. And what does this remind you of? Does this look at like a skeletal muscle membrane potential or nerve fiber or contractile cell of a myocardium or a nodal fiber? Okay, I would say what? A nodal fiber, because there is no stable resting membrane potential. Right, so it is always depolarizing after hyperpolarization. So with a normal heart rate, so this unstable membrane potential is what we call a pacemaker potential, and when it reaches threshold, of course, that's going to cause an action potential on these nodal fibers. All right, so here we see that with sympathetic stimulation on the heart, which is going to release norepinephrine on the heart and to some extent epinephrine, look at the slope of that pacemaker potential. Right, it's a lot steeper, and this is because there are more HCN channels that are opening. All right, so HCN channel is a sodium channel, so you have more sodium entering the cell that causes a rapid depolarization, so a threshold is reached at a faster time, so sympathetic stimulation increases the heart rate. So is that, what kind of agent is that? Is that a chronotropic agent or an inotropic agent that we're just describing right here? Chronotropy, and is it positive or negative? It's positive because it's speeding up the heart rate. Okay? So both norepinephrine and epinephrine open these HCN channels. Acetylcholine, on the other hand, okay, has receptors in the SA node. Now, what kind of receptors are there? This is kind of a blast from the past. Is it a nicotinic receptor or a muscarinic receptor? It's a muscarinic receptor. And remember, depending how these muscarinic receptors are coupled to membrane channels, it can either open or close a sodium channel or open and close potassium channels. In this particular case, this muscarinic receptor opens up potassium channels. And what does a potassium channel do to the membrane potential when it opens up? It allows potassium to leave the cell, and what does that do? That influences, that stimulates hyperpolarization, which is what? Antagonistic to depolarization. So if we antagonize depolarization, then the slope of this pacemaker potential gets more shallow, and it takes a longer time for these cells in the SA node to reach threshold, and that slows the heart rate down due to opening of these potassium channels due to acetylcholine binding to muscarinic receptors. All right, so both the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system can influence the heart rate right here, and that makes perfect sense because it's a very important parameter, because heart rate is helping control what? Cardiac output, because it's directly related to cardiac output. So the autonomic nervous system in an antagonistic way regulates cardiac output. All right, so there's nice precise control and balance over chronotropy of the heart due to the autonomic nervous system. Okay, let's talk about inotropy, which is what? Contractility or force of contraction. There is a part of the central nervous system in the medulla that is the cardioregulatory center. Your book calls it the cardiac control center. You could call it either one. I'll call it either one on a test. All right, this is going to regulate the rate of nerve impulses to the heart via the sympathetic nervous system. So there are sympathetic endings in the muscles of the atria and muscles of the ventricle that can increase strength of contraction. So sympathetic tone or sympathetic nerve endings have what kind of effect on the heart in terms of force of contraction? They are positive inotropic agents, right? They will increase force of contraction. And as the force of contraction increases, right, can you see what happens to the stroke volume? It's going to increase. All right, so sympathetic stimulation, what's the effect of blood flow out of the heart when the sympathetic nervous system stimulates the atria and the ventricles? If we increase stroke volume, what happens to cardiac output? It increases, right? So it increases cardiac output. And we're going to relate cardiac output to some other things later on. So you're going to notice a little bit of asymmetry here on this table. We see some nodal tissues right here, the SA node and the AV node, and then we see some contractile tissues, like the atrial muscle and the ventricular muscle, and we see that sympathetic nerves go to each of these spaces right here, the SA node, AV node, the atrial muscle, and ventricular muscle. And sympathetic stimulation on these nodal tissues always cause an increase of activity, so it is excitatory. Right, and it's a positive chronotropic agent. It's also a positive inotropic agent on both the atria and the ventricles. So sympathetic stimulation is a powerful stimulus for increasing what? Cardiac output on the heart, because it's directly related to both heart rate and stroke volume. Parasympathetic nerves, on the other hand, notice they don't go to the atrial muscle or the ventricular muscle. So parasympathetic nerves, okay, what's the effect of on inotropy of the parasympathetic nervous system? That has no effect whatsoever because those nerves don't go there. But they do go to the nodal tissues in the atria. So it can decrease heart rate, and it decreases the conduction time through the AV node that slows the heart rate down. All right, so parasympathetic affects only what it's a negative chronotropic agent, but it has no inotropic effects whatsoever. All right, let's look in detail a little bit more with stroke volume. And what the heck is stroke volume? Once again, it is the volume of blood pumped out of the heart every time it contracts. Right, and so it's controlled by end diastolic volume, right, which is the volume of blood in the ventricles at the end of diastole. And what volume is that? Is that the small volume or the big volume? End diastolic is the... Because what happens during diastole? Is the heart contracting or relaxing? The heart is relaxing, so that means blood is flowing in and the ventricles are expanding during diastole. At the end of diastole, that's the big volume. I ask that question because sometimes it's a difficult concept to see easily. It's also stroke volume is also influenced by total peripheral resistance. This is just the impedance of blood flow through arteries. Because as this impedance increases, it's harder for the heart to push against something that's pushing back. Right? So, it's influenced by stroke volume. And then, of course, the contractility or the inotropy of the heart. As the force of contraction increases, okay, then stroke volume increases. They're directly related to each other. Strength of ventricular contraction. And you're going to have to look at this whole chapter before these things become intuitive. I probably can't make these really intuitive for you to see right at the moment. But somewhere at the end of the chapter, it will probably make some sense. But nonetheless, we got to start talking about other details right here. The end diastolic volume is what we call the preload on the heart. It's the load on the heart prior to contraction, right? And stroke volume is directly proportional to preload and contractility of the heart. Strength of contraction varies with the end diastolic volume. That's why it's related to preload, which I'm going to show you on the next slide. All right, so as end diastolic volume, which one is that? The little volume or big volume? The big volume, right? The strength of contraction of the heart is directly related to end-diastolic volume under normal circumstances, which means what? As the heart is starting to stretch, what happens to strength of contraction if they're directly related? The heart gets stronger, which is really a kind of good thing, because as the heart is presented with more blood to pump, what does the heart do? It gets stronger so it can pump more blood. So that's the advantage of this relationship right here. Okay, and I'll show you why that is in just a second. Total peripheral resistance, we call this the afterload, which impedes ejection of blood from the ventricles. That's going to help. That's going to be inversely related to stroke volume. And then here is an important calculation that's done all the time on a person's heart, and it's called ejection fraction. This is kind of similar to hematocrit. Remember, hematocrit is just the percentage volume of red blood cells that make up the whole volume of blood. Okay, the whole volume of a ventricle, when it starts to contract, is what? The end-diastolic volume. That's the whole volume. But the volume that is pumped out is the stroke volume. And so we can calculate the percentage of how much blood is pumped out of the heart compared to how much blood filled the whole ventricle before it started to contract. So it's a measure of efficiency of the heart, and we call that ejection fraction, right? Normally it's about 60%. That's a very important term right here to help timing of surgeries, if somebody's going to have a valve replaced or other kinds of procedures done on the heart. And even after a certain point in time, if somebody's ejection fraction is so low, we know that the heart is never going to recover, unfortunately. That's why it's such a critical number to know for timing a surgery, because you don't want to get it to that point to where even if you replace a valve in somebody's heart, it's not going to have any effect. It's not going to help them out. Yeah. It's just that the heart can't contract any stronger to get more blood out. So there are just losses in any kind of pumping system, and there's just no pump that can pump every single drop that goes into it to be pumped out. Okay, so that's why it's right there, 60%. Maybe, for instance, it could pump more out, but then it would take a lot more ATP to do that. So the efficiency then would actually decrease. Okay, so this is a pretty good number. All right, so here is something that's going to show you how end-diastolic volume relates to inotropy on the heart, or force of contraction on the heart. And this is the Frank-Starling law of the heart. And you're kind of familiar with this already because we looked at the length-tension relationship in skeletal muscle. Remember, we said that the strength or force of contraction of a skeletal muscle is due to the resting length of that skeletal muscle. And if the skeletal muscle, before it starts to contract, is really, really short, the muscle is weak. And then as we start to stretch the sarcomere out and tell it to contract, what happens to the strength of contractions as you stretch a sarcomere out? It gets stronger and stronger and stronger until you stretch it out so much that you don't have any overlap between the actin and myosin, and then all of a sudden the force of contraction plummets because no cross bridges can form. Okay, so a similar kind of thing happens inside the heart. So here is a plot of stroke volume, which is kind of a measure of contractility of the heart. So this is the strength of the heart contraction versus the end-diastolic volume. And what the heck is that end-diastolic volume? What is that really measuring? That's the stretching of the heart, right, or the filling of the ventricles during diastole. So as the ventricles get bigger, as the heart fills with blood, right, we look at these blue lines right here, what happens to strength of contraction? It's going up, right? So end-diastolic volume is directly related to stroke volume when we look at these Frank-Starling curves right here. So as the heart stretches, it has a tendency to get stronger, which is a really nice thing. All right, so we see also three different curves right here. These three different curves were measured, okay, when we increase sympathetic nerve stimulation, which is going to be what? A positive inotropic effect on the heart. So this bottom curve right here, we can say with little or no sympathetic stimulation, right? But if we stay at one particular end-diastolic volume and increase sympathetic tone on the heart, what happens to the heart? Does it get weaker or stronger? At the exact same end-diastolic volume, the strength of contraction increases, right? Which is just saying that sympathetic nerve stimulation or increasing sympathetic tone is a positive inotropic agent on the heart. So we have to control for end-diastolic volume. And if we increase sympathetic stimulation on the heart and keep diastolic, end-diastolic volume the same, what happens to force of contraction? It still increases, right? So it's a positive inotropic agent. This is an intrinsic property of the heart, which means that this heart is making an adjustment of how it is contracting, the force of contracting, all by itself. It's related to what? End-diastolic volume. So the heart gets stronger as end-diastolic volume increases. Okay, so what is a good way to look at that? Here's a plot of tension produced by the heart versus time, and we can see three different cases right here. Here the heart is contracting what? Really strong or weakly? Very weakly. Okay, and then up over here it's very strong. And these three different cases are due to changing end-diastolic volume in the heart. So you can see as we increase end-diastolic volume, going from A to B to C to D, what are we doing to these sarcomeres? When we increase end-diastolic volume, what's happening to the ventricles? They're stretching out, they're filling up with more blood, and as they fill up with more blood, then we have a more optimal overlap of actin and myosin. You have more cross bridges that are forming, so the heart gets stronger. It increases inotropy of the heart just due to end-diastolic volume. So that's pretty important. That kind of describes if somebody has hurt themselves and they're hemorrhaging, okay, and they're in an ambulance on the way to the hospital, what can a paramedic do to preserve their cardiac function so they don't go into heart failure because they've lost a lot of blood volume? So let's consider losing blood volume. When you lose blood volume, what happens to end-diastolic volume on the heart? How much blood do you have returning to the heart? It's going way down if it's a significant hemorrhage, right? So end-diastolic volume is shrinking. What's happening, unfortunately, to contractility of the heart? It is decreasing, just the thing you don't want to happen, right, unfortunately, for that person. So what's a way to get their contractility back? You can't give them a blood transfusion in an ambulance because you haven't done a cross-match and typing. But what can you give somebody? You can give them fluids. You can establish an IV and give them saline. That increases their blood volume. You get more volume back to the heart. What happens to end-diastolic volume? Now you have more volume in the circulatory. It stretches the ventricles out. What happens to the ventricles? They get stronger, right? So that protects somebody's cardiac function when you do that for them. So that's really nice. And that's due to what law of the heart? The Frank-Starling law of the heart. Okay. Okay, so this is the Frank-Starling law of the heart right here. I'm going to draw on this board over here. I think this will be dark enough to see. The Frank-Starling law is just a little bit more complicated than that. All right, so what do we got over here? We've got contractility. We got contractility increasing in this direction, and we're going to relate that to end-diastolic volume. So what have we learned so far? What happens to contractility as we increase end-diastolic volume? It goes up, right? Kind of like this. All right, so this is what we call the ascending limb of the Frank-Starling law. But remember, if we now stretch the heart out so much that there's no overlap to actin and myosin, what happens to contractility? It starts to go down. So really, the complete Frank-Starling law curve looks like this. Once you start to stretch the heart out too much, what happens to contractility? It decreases, right? So when somebody is losing blood volume because maybe they're dehydrated or hemorrhaging, in this region right here, we what? Give fluids to the person. But this situation can develop right here when somebody's in cardiac failure, maybe renal failure, and their body starts to retain a lot of fluids. Right? Look what happens to their heart. It gets weaker and weaker and weaker. When somebody is in cardiac failure, this happens because there's too much fluid in the body. So what would we give to somebody that's in cardiac failure because their end-diastolic volume is too large? A diuretic. Maybe you have heard of that. Okay? Diuretic. Okay, like what? Like Lasix. And what would a diuretic do? Make you pee? All right, you lose blood volume, the end-diastolic volume goes back down, and what happens to contractility of that person's heart? Yeah, so Lasix can actually, it's like a miracle drug for somebody sometimes when they're in cardiac failure. All right, just by decreasing their blood volume, you can get their heart function back very quickly. So, I see some smiles out there. Are those smiles because you're totally confused, or do you see something? That's great. Okay, so Frank Starling Law is really important, okay, clinically. Okay. All right, so if that's totally confusing, maybe you got to see me during office hours. Okay. So that is due to what? The overlap of actin and myosin, which is what? Just an intrinsic property of the heart is controlling contractility. But there is also extrinsic control of contractility. So here we have a plot of relative tension versus muscle length as a percentage of optimum. Okay, and these two curves over here are for cardiac muscle, and then superimposed on that we also have a curve for skeletal muscle right here. And then this just shows the Frank Starling curve basically without epinephrine, all right, and then with epinephrine. And you know that epinephrine is what? A positive inotropic agent, so it's going to increase contractility. Let's just say at a muscle length of 80% right here without epinephrine, but with epinephrine then, right, the sympathetic nervous system increases contractility, which is basically shows what? That it's a positive inotropic effect. And that's due to the reason that these beta adrenergic receptors increase calcium within sarcomeres. And so that increases contractility, increases cycling of the cross bridges in the heart. And that sympathetic tone can come from what? Activation of the sympathetic nervous system because it goes to the ventricles, but also activation of the adrenal gland. What part of the adrenal gland is going to release epinephrine and norepinephrine? It is the adrenal medulla. Yeah, it's the adrenal medulla. You looked at the other hormones for the adrenal cortex. Okay, so here is that equation. Cardiac output is equal to cardiac rate or heart rate times stroke volume. So cardiac output is what? Directly related to both of these. If any one of these or both increase, then cardiac output increases. This is kind of an interesting graph because we see the effects of parasympathetic stimulation and sympathetic stimulation. The dotted lines means that it's going to be inhibitory. It's going to slow heart rate down or decrease stroke volume. And we know parasympathetic stimulation only goes to the nodal tissues. That's why we only see one line. It's only going to affect heart rate but not stroke volume as a result of that. And it's going to what? Decrease the slope of that pacemaker potential, decreasing heart rate. Sympathetic stimulation, because it goes both to nodal tissues and contractile tissues in the heart, is both a positive inotropic and both a positive chronotropic agent and a positive inotropic agent because it increases calcium. Okay, and it also what increases the rate of the slope of the pacemaker potential within nodal tissues. And then, so these are extrinsic effects on the heart. Here is that intrinsic effect, the Frank Starling Law. It's not going to affect the heart rate, it's going to affect what? The stroke volume or contractility. By, if we increase the stretch, if end-diastolic volume increases, that increases stroke volume, right, which will then increase cardiac output. Mean arterial pressure, right, sometimes we call that the afterload on the heart. When that pressure increases, that's going to decrease cardiac output because it's more difficult for a ventricle to pump blood into a blood vessel when it has high pressure compared to when it has low pressure. Okay, so that's why it decreases stroke volume. All right, so here's a pretty good little slide to look at. All right, so let's look at venous return for our cardiovascular system. So here we have venous return, but what effect are we really looking at when we increase or decrease venous return? What parameter are we really affecting? How much the ventricle is filling with blood, which is what? That end-diastolic volume, yeah? Okay, so venous return is just the return of blood to the heart, right? It controls end-diastolic volume, and because it controls end-diastolic volume, it controls stroke volume. And if it controls stroke volume, what else is it influencing? What else is it controlling? Cardiac output, because that's what we use to calculate cardiac output. We use stroke volume. All right, so what is it dependent on? blood volume and venous pressure, vasoconstriction within the veins, and also it's going to be controlled by the skeletal muscle pumps, how much you're exercising. Remember, when you contract a muscle, that's going to squeeze veins down and it's going to squirt blood back to the heart, that's going to help filling. And also the respiratory pump or intrathoracic pressures within the thorax will help venous return. So I think maybe we talked about this. A fluid like blood or air, gas, that's a fluid as well, will move from high pressure to low. So when we expand our rib cage so that it is low pressure inside our thoracic cavity, air is going to flow from high pressure in the surrounding air into our lungs because it's low pressure in our lungs. But that's only one fluid that will flow into our thoracic cavity. What's another fluid that will flow into our thoracic cavity on inspiration when we decrease that pressure in our thorax? The blood as well will, like a vacuum cleaner, will be sucked into our thoracic cavity. And where's your heart? It's in the thoracic cavity. So that helps the venous return. Okay. All right. So we have blood volume. As blood volume increases, that helps venous return. Negative intrathoracic pressure due to breathing, that helps venous return. And then venous pressure also helps venous return. And it just so happens that veins are highly innervated by the sympathetic nervous system. And when sympathetic nerves send signals to veins, they will constrict. And then they will help force blood back to the heart. And it just so happens that veins, we said one time, were highly capacitive vessels, which means that they can hold a lot of blood. They can dilate to an extreme degree and act as a reservoir for blood in your cardiovascular system. Okay? But when the sympathetic nervous system tells them to contract, where does that blood go? It goes back to the heart, and it can really rejoin the circulation. And it also then makes the heart contract more strongly. So if we lose blood volume by hemorrhage or by increasing urine production, right? So if we increase urine production, that will decrease blood volume. That's going to decrease return, venous return. That's going to decrease end diastolic volume. That will, under normal conditions, decrease cardiac output. And the same thing for tissue fluid. If you're dehydrated, that's going to decrease blood volume. That will make the heart, what, weak when that happens because of venous return. So venous return is kind of a nice thing to think about in terms of cardiac function. So here we see just a pie graph of all the spaces where blood can exist in your body. Okay, so it can be in blood vessels in the lungs and in the heart, okay, or systemic arteries. There's some small amount in capillaries, and then large veins and small veins, and you can see that most of the blood volume is contained where? In veins and venules. So because these are highly capacitance vessels, which means that with a small change in pressure, they can change their size dramatically because they don't have a lot of elastic tissue, right? If you think of the transmural histology of a blood vessel. Arteries are what? Really big and strong. A lot of muscles, a lot of elastic tissue, a lot of connective tissue, but veins are a lot thinner. No elastic tissue, smaller muscles, so they can change their diameter quite a bit. All right, so this blood can be returned when they start to constrict due to sympathetic stimulation. And then that blood will flow, additional blood will flow to the lungs and heart, right, and systemic arteries when that happens. So venous return is pretty important. Okay, we're going to talk some more about those things after we talk about hormonal control of the cardiovascular system. Okay, so blood volume, and as a result of that, blood pressure is controlled by three hormones. So blood volume, because it's affecting end diastolic volume, is going to affect stroke volume, which is contractility of the heart. That can either increase or decrease cardiac output, which then is going to affect blood pressure right here. Okay, so these three hormones are affecting blood pressure, right, because of this equation right here. So here's a question I want you to answer. I don't want to answer it right now. Which of the above hormones are synergistic and which are antagonistic? So synergist means what? They work together to perform the same function, right? They're directly related to each other. If one increases blood pressure, so does the other one. Antagonistic means what? If one increases blood pressure, the other decreases blood pressure. So you should understand that relationship. And here are those three hormones, antidiuretic hormone, aldosterone, and atrial natriuretic hormone. All right, so this one right here, atrial natriuretic hormone, seems a little strange. What part of the body does it come from? The atrium, right? And it's a hormone. Maybe you haven't thought of the atria as actually being an endocrine gland, but it is. Okay, so it releases this thing right here. And what is natrium? What is natrium? I don't have a periodic table, that's a hint. But it stands for, sodium, right? Because that's the Greek word for sodium, right? Atrial natriuretic hormone. So this hormone works by working on sodium inside the body. Okay, little foreshadowing. Let's talk about antidiuretic hormone first. All right, well, what does a diuretic do? Makes you pee, makes you lose volume, right? Makes you lose blood volume, makes you lose tissue volume. What happens to venous return when you're taking a diuretic? It decreases, right? Decreases force of contraction a little bit. So what is an antidiuretic? It holds water, makes you retain water. So what happens to venous return when you retain water? It increases, right? What happens to stroke volume then? It goes up, right? Okay, blood pressure goes up. So ADH is released by, and I think you know this already, the posterior pituitary, when osmoreceptors detect high osmolality, which is what? High salt. All right, so that could be due to what? Oh, drinking too many margaritas. Right, because your salt content will go way up. And then alcohol dehydrates you as well, right? Okay? Yeah. Yeah, because it's a diuretic. Yeah, so it'll put you in negative water balance when you drink coffee or any kind of, well, like methylated xanthines that you can find in tea, like theophylline or theobromine, okay, or diuretics. Okay? But antidiuretic hormone stimulates water reabsorption from urine. All right, so the kidney takes a lot of water out of your body, then you pass it as urine, but when ADH is present, a lot of water will be resorbed from that volume that's going to be urine and will be placed back in your body, so it helps you conserve water for your cardiovascular system. All right, so what is the initial stimulus? Dehydration or salt ingestion. All right, that dehydration decreases blood volume. And increased salt ingestion increases the osmolality of your blood by making it more salty. So blood osmolality increases for both of these stimuli right here that stimulates the hypothalamus. And can the hypothalamus talk to the posterior pituitary? Absolutely, because the cell bodies are in the hypothalamus, but the axon terminals are in the posterior pituitary, so action potentials go right down through the infundibulum, and it causes the release of antidiuretic hormone. Okay, this then will circulate through the blood, right? It will go to the kidneys, and it will then tell the kidneys to make less urine, to make urine that is highly concentrated, but a small volume of highly concentrated urine, so that you'll lose salt, but retain water. All right, so when you retain water, that increases blood volume. When you lose that salt, that decreases, and when you retain water, that decreases blood osmolality. And how does this correspond to the initial stimulus? Does it add to the initial stimulus or subtract from it? It subtracts from it, right? So this is a nice negative feedback loop. Also, when the hypothalamus notices an increased osmolality, it will also stimulate the thirst center, so you'll become thirsty. And of course, usually, hopefully, there's some water available and you'll drink, and that then increases blood volume and decreases blood osmolality. And as you increase blood volume, what happens to your cardiovascular system? What happens to end diastolic volume? Well, because you have increased blood volume, you have increased venous return, you have increased end diastolic volume, and then what would you invoke to explain changes in contractility as end diastolic volume increases? What's going to play there? An intrinsic property of the heart, which is what? The Frank-Starling law, right? So as end diastolic volume increases, force of contraction increases. So that's why ADH has an effect on blood pressure, because it increases venous return and contractility to the heart. Okay, aldosterone is a steroid hormone secreted from what organ? in your body. So where did ADH come from? Posterior pituitary. What about aldosterone? Close, but not quite. It's from the adrenal cortex. Adrenal cortex, not adrenal medulla, but adrenal gland, but the cortex. It helps maintain blood volume, and if it's helping maintain blood volume, what is it going to affect? Blood pressure, right? Both blood volume and blood pressure through reabsorption and retention of salt and water from the urine. So what does this sound a lot like? Antidiuretic hormone. So you could probably answer at least part of that first question on the first slide. So aldosterone and ADH work what? Antagonistically or synergistically? Synergistically. Okay. ADH is stimulated by salt deprivation, okay, low blood pressure, and low blood volume. So this is the stimulus for aldosterone release. All right, and this is going to take us to the dreaded renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. All right, but you should put an asterisk right here, because this is the most important mechanism for long-term regulation of blood pressure. All right, not from second to second in your body, like from when you're sitting down to when you're standing up, but from week to week or month to month. Okay, this is the system that regulates your blood pressure. And what can you tell me about blood pressure? Is it something that works just perfectly for everybody, or do lots of people have trouble regulating their blood pressure from day to day or week to week, month to month? A lot of trouble. What is it called? Hypertension. That's right. So hypertension is a really serious disease, and it will kill your heart, it will kill vessels, your cardiovascular system, it will kill kidney function, can kill retinas, so it's a very important parameter, and hypertension should be controlled. So we should be really interested in this system right here, the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. Okay, so when there's a salt deficit or low blood volume, angiotensin 2 is produced. Right? Angiotensin 2 causes a number of effects, all aimed at increasing blood pressure. So somebody with hypertension has what? An overactive production of angiotensin 2, or receptors to it. Angiotensin 2 causes vasoconstriction. So think of a balloon. You got a water balloon in your hand, and you're going to vasoconstrict it, which means what? Are you going to squeeze down on it or kind of pull it apart? Squeeze down. When you squeeze down on that balloon, can you imagine what happens to the pressure inside that balloon? Does it go up or down or stay the same? It goes way up. As a matter of fact, it might go up so much that what happens? It pops. You don't want that to happen to anybody's cardiovascular system, right? That's one of the reasons why hypertension is so bad. Okay? So angiotensin 2 causes vasoconstriction, which increases blood pressure. It causes the release of aldosterone, which we're going to see increases blood pressure, and it causes you the sensation of thirst, which is going to have what effect on blood pressure? If you're thirsty, you're going to quench that thirst by drinking. What happens to your blood volume? It increases, venous return increases, end diastolic volume increases, and then what happens? If end diastolic volume increases, stroke volume goes up, cardiac output goes up, blood pressure goes up. Okay, so this is a powerful system for maintaining blood pressure, for increasing, and we see it's synergistic to what? Antidiuretic hormone. So here is a really good exam figure for you to know. So what did we say? The stimulus for this mechanism right here is what? Decreased blood pressure, especially decreased blood flow to the kidneys. All right, and then there's a part of the kidney called the juxtaglomerular apparatus that releases this compound that's called renin. And renin is not a hormone, it's an enzyme. And it's going to convert something called angiotensinogen. And when you look at that word, you should go, oh, I know something about this word, even though I haven't heard of it in my life. What can you tell me about angiotensinogen? It's inactive because if you look at the suffix of this word, there's an ogen right there. So it's a very important signaling compound. It's kept in reserve in your body in an inactive form so that it can be converted very quickly at a moment's notice into the active form just by this enzyme right here. So the enzyme from the kidney called renin can convert angiotensinogen into angiotensin. But again, this is sort of like a precursor form. This is called angiotensin 1. Not very active. And in the lung, there is another enzyme called angiotensin converting enzyme. but it's too long of a term. So we just call it ACE. ACE stands for what? Angiotensin converting enzyme. Mostly this is in the lung. I think it can be found in the liver a little bit, but mostly it's in the lung, right? And that converts angiotensin 1 into angiotensin 2, and that is the active form. That's the powerful form of this hormone. This goes to the adrenal cortex. As a matter of fact, where does angiotensin 2 go? Since it's in the blood, where does it go? It goes everywhere, right? And it can communicate with the tissue if that tissue has what? A receptor for it in the cell membrane, right? Because it's a hormone. So it goes to the adrenal cortex, and there are receptors for angiotensin 2 in the adrenal cortex, which then will stimulate the increase the production and release of aldosterone, which then is another hormone, which goes back into the blood, and it goes back to the kidneys, and it causes salt and water retention by the kidneys. And when that happens, as you increase salt retention, that will drag water back into your body. Okay, and so what happens to blood volume? It's going to go up. But what was the initial stimulus? Decreased blood volume. So what kind of feedback loop is this? This is a nice negative feedback loop, which will then maintain your blood volume at some preset set level, right? Okay. What else does angiotensin do? It causes vasoconstriction of arterioles. And when you constrict a blood vessel, what happens to pressure? It goes up. Okay, and how does that feed back to the initial stimulus right here? It subtracts, so that also completes the negative feedback loop right here. All right, so this is the complete renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. You have to know the organs and what chemicals they're secreting and the effects on the cardiovascular system. So where does renin come from? From the kidneys. And it works on a protein that's in the blood. It converts it into a precursor form, and then the lung has ACE, which converts it into the active form, and then this active form goes to arterioles and to the adrenal cortex. Adrenal cortex releases aldosterone, which then works on the kidneys, because that's where that's the target tissue, because it has receptors to increase blood volume and increase blood pressure by constriction, but also increasing blood volume will increase blood pressure. Why does increasing blood volume increase blood pressure? Increasing blood volume increases venous return to the heart. That increases end diastolic volume. What happens to the heart? Gets stronger under normal circumstances. Stroke volume increases, cardiac output increases, and blood pressure increases as a result of that. All right, so somebody with hypertension, this system is not working properly. Sometimes we might know why. Maybe there is a tumor in the kidney that's secreting too much renin. Okay, that's easy to treat, relatively. Just get rid of the tumor. Or maybe there's a tumor in the pituitary gland that's stimulating the adrenal cortex. Or a tumor in the adrenal cortex that's too active. All right, but sometimes we just don't know what the reason is, but it still has to be treated. All right, so this system right here is the most important mechanism for what? Long-term regulation of blood pressure. We're going to look at a mechanism for short-term in a little bit, but this is for long-term. So somebody with hypertension can be managed with some of these pharmaceutical agents right here. All right, so if blood volume increases, if your blood volume is too high because this system is overactive increasing your blood pressure, what's the first thing that should be tried? A diuretic to do what? Decrease blood volume. All right? But then you might be saying, oh, but, you know, if the set point is set right here, if we give a diuretic, then this system might become more activated, and it's going to counter-effect the diuretic that you give somebody. And, you know, unfortunately, that's true. The system is going to try to compensate. So somebody with hypertension usually has to be on more than one pharmaceutical agent, because their body just likes to be at that hypertensive state. So diuretics is a good first thing to try. What else could we do? We want to manipulate this system right here. How about preventing the conversion of angiotensin 1 into angiotensin 2? That would be fantastic. Those are called ACE inhibitors. Really common pharmaceutical agents. But maybe somebody has really resistant hypertension. We have to give them a third pharmaceutical, like an ARB or angiotensin 2 receptor blocker. Where are these receptors going to be at? In the Where does angiotensin II work? Adrenal cortex and arterioles, right? So ARBs are going to prevent the secretion of aldosterone and cause what? Vasodilation, which will then have a tendency to lower blood pressure. Okay, beta blockers. Ooh, what do you know about these beta blockers? What are these? Are these cholinergic or adrenergic receptors? So these are receptors that are going to be blocked. Adrenergic or cholinergic? Adrenergic, right? I like beta 1 blockers. Where do you have beta 1 receptors? In the heart. Okay, when they're stimulated, that increases contractility, but when they're blocked, what happens to force of contraction of the heart? It goes down. So the stroke volume goes down, cardiac output goes down, and blood pressure goes down. So that's another agent that can be tried. Or calcium channel blockers, right, in the heart, decrease contractility, which then decrease stroke volume, decrease cardiac output, which then does what? Decreases blood pressure as a result. And so sometimes somebody has to try all these different things to manage their blood pressure, and you know what? It could take maybe a year to figure that out. But hypertension is such a serious disease. If you have any family members, you just have to support them through that process and just say, you know, that's just the way it is. Please pay attention to that, because otherwise the circumstances could be what? Renal failure, heart failure. You can lose your retinas, a lot of really bad things that you don't want to face later on in your life. So you just have to be really low-key and help somebody with hypertension to manage it, right? If you have a loved one, like your husband, for instance, has hypertension and he's not controlling it, can you yell at him? You've got to take your blood pressure medication because you're going to die if you don't. Can you do that? What's going to happen to their blood pressure? Oh, it's going to go up instead of down, right? So sometimes it's really difficult to manage. The other thing about managing hypertension through this renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism is that patients feel fantastic when they have high blood pressure. And early on, they feel lousy when they have good blood pressure. So there's a lot of negative reinforcement that they have to live through when that happens. They feel very fatigued when they have normal blood pressure, but fantastic when their blood pressure is dangerously high. So that might help out a little bit later on. Okay, here's a nice website where you can go and look at some of these different agents right here. This agent right here, alpha-2 agonist, this is a central receptor in the brain that decreases blood pressure very dramatically. That's clonidine is the trade name. And I'm not sure anybody really knows how this thing works yet, so we don't talk about it in here. But used commonly to dramatically decrease somebody's blood pressure. What's a normal blood pressure? 120 over 80, systolic over diastolic pressure, right? So if somebody shows up to a doctor's office or emergency room with blood pressure of 220 over 150, which means what? Their brain is about ready to explode. Clonidine is the drug that's given to them to decrease, where's my little arrow? Okay, to decrease their blood pressure dramatically so something doesn't bad happen right there in front of the doctor, right? So that's really serious. Okay, so that's two of the three. That leaves us, what, atrial natriuretic hormone, or peptide. So when blood volume is expanded, which means you have more venous return to the heart. So what happens to the chambers of the heart when you have more venous return? They start to stretch, they get bigger, right? End-diastolic volume goes up for the ventricles, but the atria as well. And there are stretch receptors in the left atrium, and when they sense stretch, they release atrial natriuretic hormone. All right, I like to use hormone. You could say peptide if you want. Atrial natriuretic hormone inhibits aldosterone. So now you can tell me what's the relationship between atrial natriuretic hormone and aldosterone and ADH. It's antagonistic. And is it a good idea to have an antagonistic system? Yeah, because it provides for what? Precise control and balance. You want to have that happen. Atrial natriuretic hormone promotes salt and water excretion to lower blood volume, right? And it promotes vasodilation, so it's going to decrease blood pressure. When you vasodilate, that decreases blood pressure. When you decrease blood volume, you decrease venous return to the heart due to the Frank-Starling law of the heart. As end-diastolic volume goes down, what happens to contractility? It goes down, so stroke volume goes down, cardiac output goes down, and so does blood pressure as a result. Okay, so those are three hormones that you have to become familiar with, and no doubt, here is an exam figure. that shows that. So increased water, okay, fluid in your body, increased blood volume, increases venous return that stretches out the atrium, and the atrium then will release atrial natriuretic hormone, and that increases salt and water excretion by the kidney. So there are atrial natriuretic hormone receptors in the kidney, so you'll be producing copious amounts of watery urine by the kidney, right? So increased urine volume. That water came from blood, so what happens to blood volume? It goes down, right? So what is this? How does this relate to the initial stimulus? Subtracts from it, so it's a nice negative feedback loop. But also as these receptors become stimulated, it not only causes release of atrial natriuretic hormone, it also sends signals to the cardioregulatory center, to the brain, to the posterior pituitary, and then it inhibits the amount of antidiuretic hormone. Okay, so it works in these two mechanisms to increase urine volume, right? So if you inhibit antidiuretic hormone, that's like giving a diuretic, right? If you inhibit antidiuretic hormone, that's like giving a diuretic, which will do what? Increase urine volume, which will then decrease blood pressure. Okay. So those are some real important things, and be really familiar with this mechanism here. Okay, if you are in any kind of clinical life, you'll be using this thought process every day. All right, it's really important to become familiar with it. And probably if you draw it out a couple of times, it won't be too bad. Okay, factors affecting blood flow. What the heck is blood flow again? What are the units of blood flow? Yeah? It is volume per time. So it's like milliliters per minute or something, which is blood flow. Okay, vascular resistance to blood flow. Vascular resistance, and you guys have done quite a bit in lab with this already, I think. I don't think it's a lab to do yet. I think you're mostly done with lab. Okay, vascular resistance determines how much blood flows through a tissue or an organ. Right, and vascular resistance is really determined by the degree of vasoconstriction or vasodilation. So most blood vessels are round in shape, right? So they're circular and cross-section. And we can come up with a relationship to look at resistance in terms of how that circle vasoconstricts or vasodilates. So how do you talk about how big or small a circle is? Yeah, one parameter would be the radius. And what the heck is the radius? Here is a circle, cross-section of a blood vessel. Radius would be from the center to the edge, right? That's the radius, all right? Or you could look all the way across the blood vessel, and what's that? That's a diameter, all right? But we're interested in radius. We don't really talk about diameter, but you should know that there's a little bit of a difference. So if you vasodilate something, what happens to the radius? It increases, yeah. And if you vasoconstrict, the radius decreases, right? So, and how does that relate to blood flow? Vasodilation, as you increase the radius, you increase blood flow. So they are directly related to each other, right? If you increase radius, what happens to blood flow if they're directly related? It goes up. And if you vasoconstrict, because it's directly related, if you vasoconstrict, if the radius goes down, so does blood flow. So that's what you have to think about. Okay, here's blood flow in a number of organs. I don't want to spend any time with this too much, I don't think. But notice your kidneys consume about 20% of your cardiac output. Your kidneys are highly metabolically active. They're doing a tremendous job for you all the time, and they have to be producing urine all the time, otherwise they die. Okay, brain, not quite as much, 13%. Skeletal muscles, just for maintaining the health of your body, protecting joints, right, 21%. Another org, I'm really shocked that the heart only takes 4% of your cardiac output. That seems really efficient for what the heart is doing because it never takes a break. Okay, but that's really amazing how important the kidneys are in terms of preserving your life. Okay, so let's look at the physical laws describing blood flow. So think like in terms of diffusion. How does a molecule move by diffusion? From high concentration to low concentration, molecules will flow from not concentration, but kind of an analogous kind of parameter. It's called pressure. Molecules will flow, fluids will flow from high pressure to low pressure. And if there's no pressure difference, then nothing is going to flow from one place to another, just like when the concentration gradient goes away. Okay, so blood flows through the cardiovascular system when there is a delta P, right? That's a pressure difference on two ends of a blood vessel. And the flow rate is directly proportional to that pressure difference. So as the pressure difference increases, blood flow increases. When the pressure difference decreases, then flow is going to stop. So here we have a diagram of like LA. That probably means what? Left atrium, and this L stands for left ventricle. Somebody got a little sleepy with the V right there, but that left ventricle. All right, and then I see red stuff coming out of it, which probably means that it's what, relatively high in oxygen, and it comes back blue, which means relatively low in oxygen to the right atrium. So this is one circulatory system. Which one is this right here? That is the, how many, well, oh wow, okay. How many chambers does your heart have? Very good. How many valves does it have? Four. And how many sides does it have? It's got two sides. So that means how many circulations does it have? It's got two circulations. And which one of the two is this right here? That's a systemic circulation. So I knew you could figure that out. Systemic circulation. Blood is going to flow from the left ventricle into this right atrium because pressure in the right atrium is what? Higher or lower than the left ventricle? It's got to be lower. And we can measure the pressures. The pressure in the right atrium is at zero, basically. Sometimes it's even a little bit less than that, maybe -1 or -2 or -3. Pressure in the left ventricle, right, depending on whether, or this aorta right here, depending on whether it's systole or diastole, will vary between 120 and 80. We could calculate the average, calculate the mean, and let's just say that the mean is 100 millimeters of mercury at the high end, zero at the low end. So what's the pressure difference? Well, then it's 100. Right, so that's the driving force for blood through this system. Now, what's going to impede blood through this system right here? The driving force is pressure, but what's going to decrease the flow? It's going to be the resistance. All right, so here is an equation that you should just memorize. Let me erase this thing right here. Erase the circle. So we have flow. Okay, flow is going to be directly related to one thing and inversely related to another. What will increase flow if it increases? Okay, of what's the first thing on this slide is what? The pressure difference, right? So delta P. So if you increase delta P, flow will increase. But the other thing is resistance. Right? If we increase resistance and keep pressure the same, what happens to flow? Okay, because resistance is inversely related to flow, if resistance increases, flow is going to decrease. Okay, so the two main parameters right here that determine flow are pressure and resistance. We're going to look at resistance in just a little bit, maybe even on the next slide. Okay, so I want, oh yeah, this is a really good slide. Okay, so I want you to become familiar with inversely related and directly related. If it's directly related, both parameters go up. If it's inversely related, one goes up, the other one goes down, like that. Okay, so flow rate is inversely related to resistance. So we put it down here in the denominator. It impedes the flow. All right, so let's just say, what is resistance related to? Resistance of a blood vessel is related to the length of the blood vessel. As the blood vessel gets longer, okay, you know what? In your book, it doesn't use L. Maybe somewhere it does. It uses a capital L right here, length of blood vessel. So as the blood vessel gets longer, what happens to resistance? It's directly related. What happens? It goes up. Yep, that's real important. And viscosity is the thickness of the fluid. Okay, as the fluid becomes more thick, do you think that promotes flow or slows the flow down? Slow. It slows it down, right? So resistance is, and we call that nu right here, right? That's viscosity. So as viscosity increases, the resistance increases. So if you're pumping water versus molasses, what's going to take a lot more energy to get through a tube? Okay, yeah, the molasses, because it's very viscous. It's very sticky to get through, all right? And resistance then is going to be related to the radius of a blood vessel. All right, so as the radius increases, what happens to resistance? It decreases because it's inversely related. All right, but this is not a true physical description because it's much more sensitive to a change in radius than what I've diagrammed here on this equation. It's what? It's resistance times resistance times resistance times what? I mean radius, radius. Radius times radius times radius times radius. What do we call that? That's R to the fourth power. All right? R to the fourth power. Radius to the fourth power. Oh, and this is where we got to stop. So small changes in radius make what? Huge changes in resistance right here because of the fourth power rule. And then next time we're going to put all these together and talk about Poiseuille's equation or Poiseuille's law. Oh, yeah, you know, I didn't pass the sign-in sheet around. Oh, rats. Okay, I will next time. Okay, so you know what? I probably can't drop anybody. I suppose I could drop somebody now, but I probably wouldn't. You're kind of stuck in the class. Okay, so see you on Thursday. If you want to look at your tests, see me during office hours.